Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from thousands of successful individuals from around the world. I am your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I'm delighted to welcome a very, very senior and accomplished educator, academic from Duke University, USA, Professor Anthony O'Driscoll. Tony, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Ashutosh. Great to be here.
Thank you. Professor O'Driscoll is a professor, speaker, author, and advisor. He's an adjunct professor at Duke University at the Fuqua School of Business. He's published two books on learning and organization performance and achieving desired business performance and hundreds of articles. And he has a new book coming out titled Everyday Superheroes, and we'll talk about it. I think this book has already come out. So, Tony, before we get into your key area of information technology, your key message emphasizes that the key digital age differentiator is not technology, but people. Please help me understand this with some examples.
Great. Well, you know, I think my undergraduate is electrical engineering, so I'm no stranger to technology and was very much of a techno-optimist, I would say, until the year 1993. Mm-hmm. And I was in an airplane reading an article in Wired magazine by Bill Joy, who was then the chief technology officer at Sun Microsystems. Okay. And he wrote a very influential article called Why the Future Doesn't Need Us. Mm-hmm. And essentially his argument was that if you think about the actual definition of technology, it's about the application of scientific knowledge for practical purposes. And when you say practical purposes, for what? Well, it's not actually for what, it's for who. Technology should be serving humanity. And that's the purpose, whether that's a language or a hammer or... Now, when we get into information technology, I think over the last two decades, essentially because of the exponential nature of technology, I'm starting to wonder if the machine is using us more than we are availing ourselves of the affordances of technology. So, in one way, none of these technologies would exist without us creating them. In another way, when you're moving from a world where data is the new oil and we are the creators of that data, then you start to think about, you know, is technology getting out ahead of us?
Well said.
And so that's why I'm kind of want to bring some more humanity back to technology in my own work.
So you're really reinforcing that age-old comment that we've become slaves to our own whatever devices we use all the time.
Yeah. I've taken it a little further and said maybe we're indentured data producing laborers working for server farm owners. That, you know, essentially, if you think about the work that Tristan Harris and others have done that's a question that we have to really have to explore, and I think a lot of us are unconsciously TikToking our way into it without actually pausing to question, you know, who's benefiting from having your attention commanded. Yeah,
very well said. So moving on, we are in the middle of the digital age, and I completely agree with the red flags that you are raising. Are we becoming servants or slaves of the technology that we seem to have created? But what are some of the challenges that we are facing, and where does the accountability lie?
Yeah, well, I think we might have a case a little bit here of what Bellman called unconscious collusion. Mm-hmm. That's where everybody is in a circle saying they. I think everybody has accountability here.
Correct.
Whether that's government regulation. Let's just take government regulation. Broadly speaking, there's kind of three different regimes, if you will. In the United States, companies can kind of own your data and take advantage of your data. Of course, you sign some licensing agreement, but you're in such a hurry to download the app, you don't read the 2,000 pages. In Europe, obviously, with GDPR, they're essentially trying to give a little bit more privacy back to the individual through policy. And then I think in more dictatorial regimes, perhaps most notably China, you have a more like government has access to that data and can and will do what they choose. So you know, there's accountability at the government level, but there's different policies. And then at the individual level, if I think this is a truism in any case, if we're waiting around for regulation and we're not taking proactive steps as a society or as a citizenry or as an individual, we're also part of the problem. So I really think that accountability and responsibility is at every level, and that we can't just rely on someone else, some other institution or some other organization to take care of it. So it almost has to transcend all those boundaries, you know, in order for us to not just get sucked in to a never-ending flow of data and become untethered and unmoored from what it means to be human and what it means to feel grounded and what it means to feel connected in a very human way. Even now, through this technology, we are connecting and we're having a meaningful conversation. That's very different than just sitting there and passively consuming material. I had a conversation with my son yesterday. It's finals week here in the United States, you know, final exams. And you know, you're for AP English, Advanced Placement English, you're supposed to read a book. Dad, I can watch the movie. Dad, I can. And I'm like, if you're watching the movie, you're watching somebody else's interpretation of the words on the page, right? You're not using your imagination. You're passively consuming. You're not actively engaged.
Correct.
Of course, that argument fell on deaf ears because I'm in a hurry to do other things. But I think sometimes we just need to pause a little bit.
No, you're so right. But yet, you know, I'd love to get your perspective on how the wide disparity in using technology across the developed world, the developing world, is going to be managed, because the developing world, this is very aspirational. In the developed world, this is invasion of privacy and everything else that you and I are talking about. How do we manage this imbalance in our world?
Well, just as I said, there's the government level, there's the company level, and then there's the individual level. Well, there's the culture societal level, and then there's the individual level. Let's just take those four levels. I think that culture really matters. And I know that's something you talk a lot about on this podcast. Just as my good friend John Davis were chatting about before we came on air. I also, you know, I grew up, I sound American, but I'm actually from Ireland. But I grew up all over Africa and Asia. As a child, because my father worked for the UN. And so I've come to understand that, you know, culture really, really matters. It's the assumptions you no longer question that are just so wherever you are. And that's fine if you are wherever you are. But when you move from one place to the other and you start to look at something and say, well, that's the stupidest thing I've ever seen. Why do they do that? Come up in that culture. You were not assimilated in that culture. You did not come up in that culture. You weren't assimilated in that culture. And one of the very hardest things to do is to embrace that difference and try to comprehend why it is that way, and perhaps even adopt that if it is better, different, you know, more open. So I think culture really matters. And so if you have a culture or society that is more willing to deal with a strong leader, perhaps, more willing to compromise some freedoms for whatever, then you could have a different kind of regime, right? So I do think that that's the case. Another thing that I think is very important to talk about here, though, is when the World Wide Web was created, think about what it was called, the World Wide Web. The idea was http://TCP/IP protocol. It came from DARPA. We all know that story, that it was essentially a flat topological structure that was non-hierarchical. That's very interesting as an engineer. If you think about the fact that you've created a network that's supposed to be a flat topological structure, and now you've bolted it onto the bottom of a company, which is built on a hierarchy, of a military, which is built on a hierarchy, of a government, which is built on a hierarchy. Essentially, it's flattening. The technology, by definition, is flattening and opening. Now, what's happening now, though, is we're starting to get a splinter net. This is Scott Malcolmson's work. So now we're seeing the different regimes will or won't allow different technologies. An example might be Huawei. and the big argument going on in the United States about that could be a quote unquote security risk.
Correct.
Right. Mm-hmm. So now we're starting to see, you know, in India, you have the fantastic work that Nandan Nilekani did with the Universal ID program, and your infrastructure is probably second to none. In fact, Bill Gates called that the biggest IT project on earth when Nandan took that challenge on after leaving Infosys, right? So different countries now not only have different philosophies, but they're building different technological stacks that might have different technological rules, right? Now, if you layer on top of that, there's another very interesting thing that's going on. It used to be, if we want to, in the old world, when my dad was growing up with the UN, we used to call it first world, second world, third world. Correct. Thankfully, we've moved beyond that. But
yes,
if I say in the old world, I'm referring back to those days. Mm. Developmental economics, the philosophy was as follows. If you can open up the purse strings, if you can open up the marketplace, you will then eventually open up government. In other words, if disposable income goes up, individuals who've now built a nice house with a nice view will not be willing for the government to come and say, we're moving your house now because we want to build a highway. You see what I mean? But now when you're growing, you have what we call catch-up growth, which means you build roads, you build infrastructure, you build reservoirs, you build, you know, that kind of thing. And then you've got cutting edge growth, which is innovation. Now the theory set used to say, innovation is really messy and it needs to be like Silicon Valley and you need to fail and all this kind of stuff. And it's really hard to manage. It's easy to manage catch-up growth. How many high-speed rails do we need? How many roads and bridges do we need? But when you get to what's the new form factor for information consumption, you have to do a lot of things before you figure out it's the iPad or the iPhone.
True.
So there's a lot of failures before.
Well said.
Now, here's the issue though. The issue now is as we're moving into a world where data is the new oil, data becomes the most important resource because it's data that needs to train the machines for autonomous vehicles to work without crashing. So now you have a different challenge. The challenge here when we start talking about economic growth in a data-driven AI ML world is, does an autocratic regime that controls the data have actually disproportionate leverage because they can command that resource and then train. So here's the thought experiment. Xi Jinping's already said electric vehicles and autonomous vehicles are on the roadmap. That's another element of kind of those kind of regimes. America has also said it. So you got the Elon Musks of the world doing what he's doing, and then you got that regime. The truth is, though, if you're going to need to understand how to train an autonomous vehicle to navigate a place like New Delhi, or to navigate a place like Shanghai, or to navigate a place like Chicago, you're going to need to decree that whatever, that 10 kilometers right downtown are going to be autonomous only, no other cars are allowed in, they will then, we'll know what to do. A dictatorial regime, an autocratic regime, will have more control over that particular situation. So the question that's open now is, number one, culture, number two, kind of regime, number three, then the role of who controls the data. But number four is, in this particular instance, when we're talking about machine learning and artificial intelligence, having control of that data unquestioned. Imagine, here's the final thought experiment. Could you actually get this done in Shanghai faster than you could get it done in Chicago? Absolutely faster in China.
Correct.
Chicago, there'd be five layers of government all the way down to town councils. All of that would have to be kind of, again, I'm not knocking the democratic process. I'm just suggesting that.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I mean, that's another debate we can have some other time. You know, how much democracy is good for every country and is it,
you know,
good?
I had a very interesting conversation with Nandan Nilekani about this very point.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know if we should talk about it now.
But no, we'll talk about it. Maybe we'll try and get you and Nandan on a show together and talk about democracy. But sure, I've got to keep moving on. I'd like to move now to your book, Everyday Superheroes.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit. But before we get into the book, is the book available on Amazon and all the other platforms?
Yep, it sure is. It's on Amazon right now. It's available. It's been out, I think, a month or so. Yeah, just a month and a half. It's called Everyday Superheroes.
I'm going to certainly, show us a copy. That'll be very nice.
If you have it. Looking for it.
Okay.
There it is.
There we are. Okay. Every is perfect. And so I'm going to definitely order my copy and I'm going to ask all our viewers and listeners to go to Amazon and check out Professor O'Driscoll's book. But now tell me a little bit about the book, your hypothesis in the book.
Yeah, so the book came about by doing actual detailed research for an institution called the Project Management Institute, which a lot of people know about. Project Management Institute is essentially a very large kind of body that essentially trains project managers, right? And it's a fungible credential. If you're PMI certified, you could move from GlaxoSmithKline to IBM to to across industries, because it's like the basic blocking and tackling of on time, on budget, in scope, those kind of things. And they recognized, as many of us have, that 70% of the time, the express strategy, the strategy that a company says they want to pursue in order to create value, doesn't get realized. It doesn't come to fruition. Now, that could be because of an external variable, like some kind of disruption like COVID, or largely because of internal variables, culture. Or come back to culture. We're just talking about culture at the kind of macro level, but now let's talk about culture. And you've run many companies yourself, so I'm sure you'll probably agree. I had the great fortune. I think one of the things in life I think your life is determined by the amount of mentors you've had in moments. And so I had at one point in time when I worked at IBM, I worked for a gentleman named Larry Prusak. And Larry Prusak was the founder of Knowledge Management. He's the one who wrote all the books on knowledge management. And he wrote a very influential article in Harvard Business Review called People Make Organizations Stop or Go. And I think that's true. I think that if you can have all the technology and all the process and all of the kind of metrics and all of the measures, but if people don't believe in the change that's being imposed upon them, they won't behave in a way that makes the organization change. So one of the premises of the book is belief before behavior, that people don't resist change per se. That's why we're still here and dinosaurs aren't. We are adaptive species, but they resist being changed. Don't tell me what to do, right? So the premise of the book is essentially everyday superhero. Everybody in an organization can be a superhero.
Correct.
But in order for them to be so, you need to unlock their discretionary effort. Now, what is discretionary effort? Discretionary effort is what they want to do because they want to, not because they're told to. Another way to say that is, what's their source of meaning or purpose? And if you can tap into each individual's source of meaning or purpose and create autonomy plus accountability, you unleash the capability for an organization to be adaptable, to be responsible. When I say responsible, I'm saying response. Organizations have to be far more agile and responsible than they were before, because the world's far more unpredictable, given everything we've just dealt with between COVID, Ukraine, 2008 financial crisis, the year 2000. Remember Y2K? We thought every machine was going to stop. And by the way, unfortunately, this is just the beginning of what we're going to see in terms of things we didn't anticipate that would happen that are actually happening.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So I've got time for two more questions, and I'm going to move back to technology and everyday superheroes and how technology seems to be impacting everyone with the advent of the metaverse, where everybody seems to be now talking about the metaverse without really understanding what the implications are. I'd love to get your perspective.
Now, I'm not sure if you know this or not, but when I worked at IBM Research, I actually spent 3 years deeply researching the metaverse a decade ago. In fact, my last book, Learning in 3D, was all about this. And so I think the metaverse, it's one of those things, if something is truly transformational, right, there's this real paradox about it. It happens slowly, then suddenly, right? It's everything's stable, and then there's a shock. It's overhyped in the short term, but underhyped in the long term. So this is where I would categorize the metaverse. You know, if you're familiar with the Gartner's hype cycle or whatnot, that the metaverse right now, it's become a vernacular. And when something becomes a vernacular, then it can mean anything that it means to anyone at any time. And that's a problem. But I do believe, and this is based on my prior research when I was at IBM Research, that this time around, this is going to be truly a differentiator. I felt 10 years ago it could be. Mm. I think there were two key barriers. They were both technological. Well, there was a cultural barrier and a technological barrier, but the technological barrier was bigger. The capacity in each client, in each computer to actually render out the graphics was a problem. Mm. And the capacity to actually do that over the air was a problem. Both of those are no longer problems. We've been through five different generations of technology inside the client laptop. So, you know, and also gaming has really driven this. So, so if my kid wants to play Fortnite or Halo, they're using the kind of computer that you would have spent tens of thousands of dollars 10 years ago. So that's not a problem. And with 5G, we're done. So there's no latency and the processing power in computers are there and the rendering is good. So I think there's no technological hurdle anymore. Now I think the challenge, the other thing I'll say is, I think there's a really, really, really big gulf here in that the Generation Z, Gen Z, Nikhil Raval, who's a good friend of mine, wrote a book on Gen Z there in India. Okay. They are quite familiar with navigating metaverses and having multiple identities. They're popping into, you know, whatever, Instagram with their avatars, so on and so forth, into TikTok and creating their own kind of content, into Fortnite and doing what they have to do in Fortnite. So they're quite facile and comfortable moving into different contexts that are not just, oh, I'm in PowerPoint and now I'm in Word. Metaverses. Now, if you're a technologist, which I am, what you got to do is you got to look at what makes the metaverse different. And I've got seven sensibilities that I talk about that make the metaverse different. One is the sense of self. Okay. When you are inside a metaverse, your avatar is your cursor. So you kind of, you have agency inside the environment. Does that make sense? That's very different than just observing because you're actually now in the space. Depth of distance means you and I could both be in a room. I still feel like we're somewhat at a distance here because I see your screen. I know you're in New Delhi. The power of presence, when you're co-present, we're together right now, but we're split screen. When you're co-present, even with your two avatars, we know this from research, that co-presence really brings the possibility of creativity together.
Okay.
The sense of space. You can now not just be anthropomorphized as a human being. You could go in and be a ribosome in a cell, or you could go be a planet on an, you could experience what it's like to be something other than yourself to get a better understanding of cellular biology or planetary ecosystem. The capability to co-create. This is one of the things that all of the companies, IBM, Cisco, everyone back then was looking at is, can we actually have aha moments, eureka moments, Archimedes moments at a distance? You know, can we facilitate innovative, co-creative thinking at a distance? We can teach people stuff at a distance, but can we actually have that? I firmly believe you can. The pervasiveness of practice, about you can go over and over again. This is what all of the games, World of Warcraft, Fortnite, my son, they go watch videos of what they've done to try to make it better. So you're only limited by how much practice. And then the enrichment of experience that you can have truly transformative experience inside the virtual world just as you can inside the physical world. Let me give you an example. At Duke, we don't anymore, but we had one of 10 things called Dive, Duke Immersive Virtual Environment. I am Irish. I have a phobia. It is a phobia about snakes. That's St. Patrick's fault. He banished all the snakes from Ireland. So I now live in America. Lots of snakes in North Carolina. They freak me out. So there's a phobia treatment where they put you into this dive, Duke Immersive Virtual Environment. And then they say, okay, you are now standing in a white room. And you look around, yes, I'm in a white room. And then they hit a button and all of a sudden it's like you're Indiana Jones in the snake pit. And your whole body just freaks out. But the therapist is saying, now listen, you were just in a white room. But the point is, your mind doesn't know the difference.
Correct.
You see? And so the enrichment of experience, the use of VR technology, even back then, when I was doing the research for post-traumatic stress disorder, is very, very powerful. So I think if you understand those seven sensibilities, then you get freedom. You can create experiences where you have flow, repetition, experimentation, engagement, doing, observing, and motivation, freedom. And so you can, I think if we design the metaverse correctly and we don't fall prey to something I call the routinization trap, which is if I see another classroom with a whiteboard and desks and avatars sitting in the classroom, shoot me. Because we've just recreated the old paradigm in a new world where we could have something completely different. And that's just in education. Absolutely. So That's my 2 points.
Well said. No, this is fantastic. And someday I'll reach out to you for a longer conversation on the metaverse, given that you worked on it 10 years ago. But my last question to you, and I'm going to ask you to wear your professor hat all over again. And this is for the thousands of people who will listen to our conversation in India and the US. What would you say are three lessons you would want our young viewers and listeners to take away from our conversation?
Three lessons. Well, the first lesson I will say, because the audience, I teach in the Master's of Engineering program and the MBA program at Duke University. And this is more drawing from my experience with the Master's of Engineering students, because I was one. Those students come in to do an MEM program, Master's of Engineering Management. And I guess my first lesson, if you're a student, is it's not about the grade, it's about the learning.
Okay.
So I often ask my students at the end of class, what class did you learn the most in?
Yeah.
And they say, oh, it was this class or that class. I said, well, what grade did you earn? Oh, I earned this grade, but I should have gotten a higher grade. I said, that doesn't matter. When you are educating at a, you know, collegiate level or a master's level, particularly, it's not about the grade. It's about how much you've learned. And unfortunately, those two things don't necessarily correlate. So that's one. So one is it's about the learning, not the measurement.
Mm-hmm.
The second I would say is follow your curiosity.
Yeah.
I would say for me, I think if you're following your curiosity, you're always going to be motivated intrinsically to figure things out. And so I think that would be the second one.
Yeah.
And the third would be listen with humility, because none of us is as smart as all of us. And if you encounter someone or something that's at odds with what you currently believe, don't assume that what you believe. I'm a big fan of having strong opinions weekly held.
Correct.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So I say those things: learning, right? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Curiosity,
and humility.
Fantastic,
Tony. On that note, and your amazing three lessons of learning, curiosity, and humility, thank you so much for speaking to me. Thank you for talking to me about your journey, thank you for talking about the information technology and all that's happening in the digital age. And I think we've just about begun to start talking about it when we run out of time, but I could have many, many, many conversations because I know our audience will love it. And thank you for talking to me about everyday superheroes. I mean, I think that is a very, very powerful communication that I think you're making through your book. I will certainly...
One thing I'll say about the book just very quickly is it's not actually a book, it's a graphic novel.
Thank you for listening to the brand called You Videocast and Podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for the brand called You.